This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live our third and final day this week from New York City, from Air America headquarters in beautiful Manhattan. Had a great time last night at the Screening Liberally gig. It was standing room only. What a great bunch of people. And we had a fine conversation. And then went back to Jerry's apartment and watched the CNN special, which we had recorded. Christiane Amanpour's the first segment of God's Warriors, which was remarkable. I've spent a lot of time in Israel, and I have one of my very best friends lives in a settlement on the West Bank, and I thought it was a very, very balanced presentation of the information. Anyhow, we'll get into that, and just everything else that's in the news here as time goes on throughout the next 3 hours of our program. But first, Matt Carruthers is with us. He's with the he writes and publishes over at NorthStarWriters.com, and he's has a new interesting new article here. Hillary Clinton Corleone mortgage lender. Does the federal government have any responsibility to help the average American get the American dream? Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
You are of the opinion that I thought this is interesting, comparing Hillary Clinton to Vito Corleone.
Correct. If you look at if you watch the movie, if you read my column, there is a distinct a similarity between the tactics used by Vito Corleone and what Hillary's proposing right now with this mortgage bailout plan.
How so?
Well, first of all, you have to go back and look at how Hillary Clinton and John Edwards and others who have proposed similar plans, Barney Frank. And kind of look at the ideology behind what they're doing. Basically, just like Vito Corleone, they view those who defaulted on adjustable rate subprime mortgages that they could not afford as just helpless losers who were manipulated by big businesses, these evil mortgage companies, and they cannot survive without the helping hand of Don Vito government.
Well, first of all, I don't recall ever hearing Hillary Clinton refer to anybody who lost their home to a subprime lender as helpless or as an idiot or any of the pejoratives here that you're using. And secondly, what did Vito have? What does that have to do with mortgages?
Okay. Well, first of all, if you read Hillary's plan, the underlying tenet of that plan and basically of liberalism in general is that people cannot get along without government to help them. If you read through her plan, she blames absolutely every entity in the entire mortgage industry as to blame except the borrower.
Well, if I can respectfully correct you, mm-hmm. the foundation of liberalism, as laid out by George Washington, our first liberal president who proudly called himself a liberal and said, "I hope to ever see America at the forefront of liberalism," it was not that government... that we can't survive without government, but that when we organize ourselves together as a society, there are inevitably going to be predators among us. There are inevitably going to be people who attempt to rip us off or who take advantage of us, particularly as society gets large enough that people can operate anonymously. And so we collectively, we the people in the United States, our government is not an it and it's not an out there. It's us. We the people collectively get together and say, there's some things here that we're going to protect ourselves from. We're going to protect ourselves from people who want to put lead in our baby aprons. We're going to protect ourselves from people who want to sell us poisoned food. We're going to protect ourselves from people who want to sell us defective goods. We're going to protect ourselves from incompetent doctors. And frankly, all Hillary Clinton, in my opinion, is saying is we're going to protect ourselves from a lending industry that has basically been peddling, that's been hustling.
Well, you're exactly wrong about that, Mr. Hartman. I respectfully disagree. What she's peddling is a $1 billion housing trust fund to help what she calls at-risk borrowers avoid foreclosure.
Right, but the Republicans want to bail out the big banks. Hillary is saying let's bail out the average person. Well, they already have. I mean, Greenspan's dropped the overnight bank lending rate here by 50 basis points.
Well, Greenspan's not the Fed chair.
I mean, I'm sorry, Bernanke.
Correct. No, what she wants to propose is a $1 billion housing trust fund. You can read it on her website. You know, in other words, she wants to require responsible taxpayers to subsidize the mortgage payments of people who cannot comprehend the word adjustable in adjustable rate mortgage. It's no harder, it's not difficult to understand. You know, the borrower must assume responsibility for educating himself, sir.
Yeah,
so
well,
entire sections of books.
I am a big fan. I think we all are big fans of individual responsibility. And there are times when you're taking on an industry that is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to advertise a particular reality to you, and you're living in a society that by and large promotes that, and you've got a Fed that Fed chairman in the form of this was Greenspan, who's driving down interest rates and creating first a stock market bubble and now a housing bubble, and everybody is being told, oh, don't worry, that yes, it's going to go up in 2 years, but your house value is going to go up. They're averaging 7 to 9% increase every year. So, within 2 years, you'll easily be able to roll over this mortgage, and which is the sales pitch. And I know that's the sales pitch.
You are exactly making my point for me, which is these liberals who are running for president and in Congress believe that the average American citizen is incapable of comprehending, how to go about borrowing money and working and paying that back without protections from government.
If you want to phrase it that way, I'm not going to strongly disagree with you. What I would suggest is that we have people who graduate from high school in the United States and they don't know how to balance a checkbook.
That's correct.
And in fact, the vast majority, because it's not something that's taught. They don't know how to diaper a baby. They don't know how to have a decent relationship. They don't, just the fundamental stuff that we are, and they don't know how to apply for a mortgage. Absolutely. And it all started, in my opinion, with Ronald Reagan going in and saying, the schools are the problem. The government is the problem. We've got to privatize the schools. Let's just turn them over to private corporations and starting to rip the guts out of our public education.
Sir, history did not begin in 1981 on January 20th. And Ronald
Reagan, but the destruction of the public education system in the United States did.
No. The problems that we are facing right now in the country as far as government and spending began in the 1960s with LBJ. And if you want to go back to the 1930s with all of
why is it that we have a mortgage crisis that only has about a 5-year lifespan on it, and it wasn't happening in the 70s and 80s and 90s?
Correct. First of all, I wouldn't call it a crisis.
Something that dropped the market 1,000 points.
The reason why is because the interest rates came down. People took out loans they could not afford because they do not understand, they did not educate themselves on how to borrow money.
I would submit to you that the reason why is because for most of the history of mortgage banking and banking in general, we had strong regulations that prevented lenders from engaging in practices that are questionable like this. And when George W. Bush in 2001 and frankly Alan Greenspan decided that ninja loans, no income, no equity, no assets, were just fine, and no job even, that they would deregulate the mortgage lending industry.
Who signs the mortgage, sir? Who signs the
Well, the bank signs the mortgage as well as the mortgagee. And that, I've got a lot of problems with that boilerplate, but my point is that this has been brought about when we were regulating the banking industry. We did not have this kind of potential disaster, and now we do, and it's a failure of regulation and which is us protecting us through government.
What they're going to end up doing is obliterating the idea of risk and reward for investments. And if Hillary's elected and if this program goes through, the element of risk in borrowing and investing capital will completely disappear.
No, what she is suggesting doing is, number one, helping out the people who have been basically bamboozled, and number two, returning back to the system the regulations that allow capitalism to function efficiently. Capitalism can only function as long as the government behaves in a socialistic fashion. You know that as well as I do.
No, I don't. You are completely out of line.
You have to have a government that controls the currency. You have to have a government that provides for the commons, that provides a court system, that is all paid for with taxpayers' dollars.
Well, the tragedy of the commons will result in socialism. And what she, go on her website if you don't believe me, she's proposing a pool of money no different than the Social Security system.
Which you consider socialism.
It is socialism, the Social Security system. And it, you know, you asked at the outset, what can the federal government do, or does it have a responsibility to help the average American achieve the American dream? Yes. It's called rescind the 16th Amendment, rescind the income tax code, restructure these bankrupt entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and replace them with personal defined.
Do away with the SNL bailout, do away with the 1870 grants to the railroads that are still in effect for all practical purposes. Do away with the legal sanction of limited liability on corporations.
Hey, the American dream is not to have Uncle Sam or Aunt Hillary make your
house. But Uncle Sam gives limited liability to corporations. Should we take that away?
Risk is the basis of financial growth in
no,
the
corporations have diminished risk.
Stick
around for a minute here, Matt, if you want to continue this conversation.
Sure.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
So we're back talking with Matt Carruthers. Matt is a writer over at NorthstarWritersGroup.com, conservative author, and of the opinion that Hillary Clinton, with her $1 billion plan to bail out people who got snookered by the SNL industry, in her point of view, and frankly in mine as well, certainly not in Matt's, is a terrible socialist plot. And Matt, I wanted to drill down into this. You know, where do you draw the boundaries? Because if you think Social Security is socialism, then I think the majority of Americans would have to call themselves socialists. Do you think that? For example,
I wouldn't say a majority of Americans would have to call themselves socialists, because actually a majority of Americans prefer the President Bush plan to give everybody, to create a defined contribution account where you own your own account. A majority of Americans supported that plan. A majority of seniors who were scared, by the liberals may not have agreed, but a majority of Americans.
I'm not buying it, Matt, and the pollsters aren't buying it either.
The pollsters aren't buying it. The pollsters 2 years ago and two and a half years ago when President Bush rolled out that plan, that's what the polls showed.
Yeah, well,
go look them up.
If it was, it would be happening. I mean, it doesn't.
People in America
like the idea of a pension, of a defined return, defined benefit, of a guaranteed income for the rest of their lives, rather than just saying, okay, I've managed to save $112,000. Now, how long can I live after I retire on that? Oh, 2.5 years. Okay, where are the strychnine pills at the 2.5 years?
Well, that's a very cynical view, but
that's the reality that you've got a lot of people facing. I mean, the reason Social Security was passed was because the major cause of death among old people in the 1930s was poverty. It was starvation in the summer and hypothermia in the winter.
Okay. The reason Social Security reform did not pass is because nobody in Congress had the intestinal fortitude to take it up, Republican or Democrat.
Okay, well, here's my question. I mean, getting back to your definition of socialism, you say that people should be willing to take risk. We should have a risk-based society.
Individuals and companies.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. So when I've created a number of corporations in my life, every time I do, one of the reasons that I do, and the reason that the vast majority of people who create corporations do so, is because the government grants you limited liability from a variety of things and a whole bunch of special privileges. You know, as an individual, I can't write off the cost of lunch and not pay taxes on it. As a employee of a corporation, I can. Do you think all those laws should go away?
Well, you'd have to look at it on an individual basis. But back to the original.
Do you think corporations should have limited liability?
Should who have limited liability?
Corporations.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, that's socialism. That's the government saying, hey, we're going to help you out. We're going to bail you out. If you get in trouble, if you do something that an individual did, you're not going to get in trouble for it.
The point of this whole housing plan is to make people who are contributing, taxpayers, pay the mortgages of people who cannot. And if you look through history at the history of government subsidies, this is just another subsidy, they completely distort the free market. Let's look for just one quick example at government subsidies to ethanol right now. In the past year, this is U.S. Department of Commerce statistics.
Matt, you and I are not going to disagree on that. So I've got a problem.
then you should agree that government subsidies distort the free market.
But here's my point. What happened to usury? We used to have, we had laws in the United States up until the late 1970s, that, or the early 1980s, I forget which it was, I think it was the late 70s, that said that if you charge more than 10% interest, you were guilty of a crime that you could go to prison for. It was a felony. Usury was a felony in the United States. What's wrong with saying, wait a minute, we the people are going to protect ourselves from the predators among us? You've got, you know, you got 16 pages of fine print. You got to be a lawyer to understand it. And you're saying, well, tough luck. You didn't understand it. You didn't go to law school.
But let's look at, for example, what happens right now. Without the usury laws, have actually allowed more people to purchase cars and purchase homes.
And go deeper and deeper into debt. And I'm telling you, people are not, you know, right in those mortgage contracts, if you've ever signed one, you know, and in most contracts these days, credit card and everything else, it says any verbal representations made to you are irrelevant. They don't count. So the salespeople can say absolutely anything. They can lie their teeth off, and then they hand you this 10, 12-page document full of fine print and say, okay, you've got 5 minutes to sign this thing. You know what? You expect most people to actually read the entire mortgage document?
Yeah, I would, and that's why when I've purchased homes before, I've
so you have
an attorney.
You have signed away your rights under the Constitution. You realize most mortgage boilerplate says that you're signing away your rights under at least two amendments to the Constitution. It says it explicitly right there in the mortgage document.
Well, before we bleed for these folks, or our hearts bleed, let's look at how many credit cards have they maxed out. How large are their high def TV sets, sir? You know, how big is their DVD collection? And there's another thing that no one's
talking
about.
I don't think the average family that is struggling to decide whether they're going to pay for medicine or pay for food, the average family that you've got 10 million Americans who have experienced, according to the Bush administration, food insecurity. They don't know where their next meal is going to come from. I don't think they're worried about, or I don't even think they have a high-def TV.
Then why don't we rescind the income tax code that takes out, with FICA anyway,
why don't we say
12% of their possible
FICA is Social Security and Medicare. It's providing for old age and providing for medicine. Why don't we instead say if you or I want to run a business, you have to pay people a decent wage?
The stock market provides a better return than Social Security ever will, which is negative.
And to hell with widows, orphans, and the disabled, which is a third of all Social Security payments.
Well, if there's somebody disabled, we can have programs to help them, but that's not the majority.
Okay, Matt Carruthers, NorthStarWriters.com. Thanks for the conversation, Matt.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Pause to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. It saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees. You see, some liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the ability to be a contributor in our society. Joe begins his workday. He's got a good pay with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation, because some liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. It's noontime. Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay some bills. His deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system during the Republican Great Depression. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some stupid liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. He's home from work. He plans to visit his father this evening at a farm home out in the country. He gets in his car for the drive to Dad's house. His car is among the safest in the world because some liberal fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home. He was the third generation to live in a house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Those rural Republicans would still be sitting in the dark. He's happy to see his dad, who's now retired. His dad lives on Social Security and his union pension because some liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. After his visit with Dad, he gets back in his car for the ride home, turns on a radio show, and some host keeps saying, "Liberals are bad, conservatives are good." Doesn't tell Joe that his beloved Republicans have fought against every single protection and benefit that Joe enjoys throughout his day. Joe, listening to this conservative talk show, agrees. He says, "We don't need these big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have." Yeah. Mary in Orange County, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Mary. Welcome.
Touche. Thank you, Tom. I was so angry listening to that man. I would start getting upset with myself for letting him get to me. I think he missed the part where the entire country rose up against the Social Security reform.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm a mortgage underwriter, and I'm going to talk about a part that a lot of people haven't been hearing about this whole mess. In the underwriting has been slowly being turned over to automated systems. Besides the unscrupulous brokers and loan officers who actually changed people's figures that they wrote down on their applications so that they could get them to qualify through these machines, once it's run through and it says approve, an underwriter is taken out of the picture.
There's no longer a human being in the process, you mean?
Exactly. By the way, this is where all of our mortgage underwriting and loan processing jobs are going, everyone. Here's the next industry that's going down. I'm not sure who, I haven't found out who puts in the qualifying, I don't know how you say it, whatever makes it become qualified.
Who defines the criteria?
The parameters.
Probably somebody in India.
Exactly.
Running the computers for Citibank or whatever.
But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have joined right into this whole scary little scenario, and everyone keeps saying subprime loans, but Fannie and Freddie have become subprime lenders,
right?
Because they were also offering stated income, stated asset.
Right. In other words, nobody is double checking to see that when you say that you actually have a job, you actually have it. When you say that you're actually earning, say, $100,000 a year, you are, and you're not just a greeter at Walmart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. We had someone that was working at Walmart, and come to find out, they said they made $10,000 a month.
Yeah. Now, actually, Mary, in the case of that person, I think you and I would probably agree with my last guess that guy shouldn't have gotten a loan, and that guy gets what he deserves if he loses his house. But the larger problem here is all these people who are coming in and they're saying, yeah, I work at Walmart and I make $1,000 a month, and the mortgage underwriter says, okay, well, I'll tell you what, we're not going to write that down on the form, and
exactly.
Sometimes doesn't even inform the person. Simply says, okay, you make $1,000 a month, and then they type in $10,000 a month, and that's what goes off to the computer, and that's a widespread and well documented practice in this industry.
Well, also these underwriting systems were heavily weighted in on the side of the property. So there was people that were told that they qualified because all of these mortgage companies were also assuming that the properties would continue to evaluate.
Right. So these were just purely based on equity and not at all based on ability to pay.
On teaser rates for ARMs instead of how it used to be, where you had to qualify at the worst possible scenario in the ARM.
Yeah, and I remember those days, and it was tough to buy a house. I remember the first time that Louise and I ever bought a house. I remember when it was tough to get a credit card. I was 22 years old before
my
first credit card.
You didn't have a 30-day late on your credit card and get a mortgage when I started this business.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big deal when I first got my first American Express card. It was like, wow, and it was incredible. It was
A mortgage, if they rolled in with a 30-day late on their shell card, they had to have a good explanation, and most likely they were out of a loan.
Yeah.
And it has deteriorated, and the Democrats have been fighting for this since like 2000. They've been trying to get it changed, and Greenspan just went right ahead and kept encouraging lower there.
Right. Greenspan was initiated into Ayn Rand's cult in New York City back in the 1950s. He's an objectivist, a hyper-uber-libertarian, hyper-conservative, who absolutely believes that there should be, for all practical purposes, no government regulation of anything. And this is what brought us the stock market disaster. It's what brought us Enron.
Exactly.
And now it's what's bringing us the housing disaster.
And the Democrats are trying to provide a pool for people to refinance, not to give up and pay for their loans for them. They're trying to get them fixed-rate loans.
No, I think Hillary Clinton's program is great. John Edwards has a very similar program. Mary, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Steve in New York City. Hey, Steve.
Hey, when I was listening to this individual, something came to my mind. I'll just tell you, I'm an attorney in New York. Mm-hmm. I worked for a small firm, and we had a couple clients who were very well-to-do. And one of the clients, his elderly mother, was in a nursing home, assisted living. She owned a property, and one of these mortgage people came to her offering her to refinance with these loan papers. To make a long story short, it took me as an attorney, I can't tell you how many days of reading over these documents, talking with this loan officer, to try to ascertain what these papers even said.
Right.
So it just underscored your point that, some of these people are just average Joes out there. And if it took me all this time and looking on the internet and finding these terms and these, and they use these obscure indices that are you know, European indices or Asian market indices,
right.
And if you don't have the wherewithal to do that, and you know, it's, again, I'm all for personal responsibility as you are, but the point is that when you have two completely unequal people looking across the table at one, each other,
right.
And this mortgage person knows full well that the, this person doesn't know and has no obligation to explain, the person's nothing more than a victim.
Right. I absolutely agree. Very well said, Steve. Thank you very much. And you as a lawyer, I mean, you know, you, taking you days to figure it out. It's like, what do you do when you're presented with 16 pages of legalese and you say, sign this if you want to get the home? And you can't say, well, I'll go to the bank down the street. They'll only give me one page in plain English, because there isn't a bank down the street that's offering one page in plain English. There isn't. And so, anyhow, it's Benita in Los Angeles. Hey, Benita.
Hi, I'm a proud Bleeding Heart liberal.
Okay, good on you.
And I just called to say that I have no problem helping people pay for their mortgages. If I give a little to help a lot of people, that's okay with me. But my real concern was that, once again, the focus is on Hillary Clinton and her plan. And this plan was actually brought up by John Edwards during the debates on Sunday.
Right.
And I just very much get annoyed that everything focuses on Hillary.
Yeah, Edwards was the first to propose this. And you know, it makes perfect sense given his background that he would. You know, both his background as an attorney who always fought for the little guy and his background as a kid who grew up, you know, basically poor, you know, working class poor. And I'm telling you, Edwards is the guy that corporate America is most afraid of. Edwards is the guy that General Electric does not want to see elected. Edwards is the guy that the big media is most afraid of. They don't want to have their monopolies broken up. They don't want to have their they want to maintain their protections and their limited liabilities and whatnot. He's the guy they're afraid of, and that's why he's the guy they're not talking about. They're trying to set this thing up so that it's Hillary or Obama, because the Republicans feel that those are the two most defeatable Democrats. And that Edwards
agree more.
Thanks a lot, Benita. And that Edwards is the one that's going to be the most difficult to defeat. And I'm telling you, that's why you hear very little discussion of him in the talking head shows, even though he's out ahead in Iowa, for example, and has been for months. I don't think most people know that. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Not your appearance that I hold it as. It's not your manners, but that you gotta improve. Ooh, it's your attitude. Your attitude.
And just to set the record straight, this from the Washington Post by Jonathan Weissman, and a special tip of the hat and thanks to the person who emailed this to me. Actually, it's just the only thing on here is his email address, so I'm not going to give that up. But anyhow, thanks for this. The 3 months after this, from the Washington Post, an article. What is the date on this thing? This is from March of 2005. 3 months after President Bush launched his drive to restructure Social Security by creating private investment accounts, public support for his program remains weak, with only 35% of Americans now saying they approve of his handling of the issue, according to a new Washington Post ABC poll. While the White House has helped convince more than two-thirds of those polled that Social Security is headed for a crisis, 56% disapprove of Bush's approach, a survey of 1,001 adults conducted March 10th through 13th shows. By comparison, 38% approved of his handling the issue, and 52% disapproved of it in mid-December. He's now up to 56% disapproval. 58% of those polled this time said the more they hear about Bush's plan, the less they like it. The latest poll, combined with detailed interviews last week, shows that Bush's drive to significantly alter the 70-year-old national insurance program has run into significant hurdles with every age cohort. So, you know, just set the record straight. Beverly in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Beverly, welcome to the program.
Oh, how you do. I love to talk to you. Listen, I was an economics high school teacher at a school on the Lower East Side, which had 98% Chinese immigrants. And they said to me, you are not only going to teach three courses, three impossible courses. One was the history of the 60s through music, which I had to bring records in for, you know, and everything, and do research.
That sounds like fun, actually.
The other was economics.
Right.
And I had a wonderful assistant principal named Dr. Lee, who gave me an assignment. He said, tell each student, now this is the way you become intelligent in economics, you know, and not teach in a half-baked way. Each student would take a business, and a lot of the Chinese kids' parents did have businesses or wanted to. And as we come to each topic, you're going to apply it to that business, like whether it's distribution or production or whatever.
Right, or salaries.
And believe me, they learned a lot because they, you know, it was graphic. I brought in a lot of pictures and stuff. Yeah.
That's great.
Well, that's what I'm saying. We do have to have individual responsibility. But I was pretty smart, and I taught.
But you know,
in
Beverly,
college.
You can't do that anymore in the United States because you've got to teach to the test, to the No Child Left Behind test.
No, you don't. You can always bring in supplements, and they don't know the difference.
Okay.
If you're being observed, then you teach the text. But let me tell you one more thing. I had a balloon mortgage, and here I was, so smart in economics, I thought. I was a social studies teacher, but I was also teaching in college anthropology. So I have a lot of background in social sciences, which are not the soft sciences, by the way. I hate that term, soft and hard. That's because they're afraid of you when you teach social sciences. Anyway, the point is I had a balloon mortgage. I didn't even know what it meant. I figured, well, 3 years, I'll pay it up. So guess what happened? In 3 years, no bank would give me a loan.
Oh, no.
And I lost the house to foreclosure.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Sometimes you're so educated and you have a lot of background, and you still can be victimized in this system.
There you go. Beverly, thank you for sharing your story with us. And, here you are, 16 pages of legal fine print. And by the way, the stuff that they really don't want you to read, they put in all caps because readership studies show that when things are in all caps, people read it about half as fast as stuff that's, you know, just normal upper and lower case. Gabriel in Woodhaven, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Gabriel.
Hi. I just had to laugh at your last guest. It's okay for somebody to go to work every day and pay their taxes and lose their house and take their tax money and bail out the corporation or the mortgage company that they lost their house to, but they can't use their own tax money to benefit themselves. I don't know where he gets his logic from.
Well, and I don't want to, you know, pick on Matt because, frankly, he's representing a worldview that's widely held across the Republican Party and by people who call themselves conservatives. You don't want to have socialism in the United States. I mean, these people are so afraid of what they call socialism. And socialism, at least the way it's practiced by Western European countries and Northern European countries, is we the people looking out for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as opposed to Soviet-style socialism, which was really tyranny. And they're two completely different things. And I think that there's a lot of people out there who have not figured out the difference between the two. Gabriel, thank you very much for the call. Nice to hear from you. Morgan in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morgan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just had an idea that's been kicking around in my head for a couple of years since the bankruptcy bill went in that kind of speaks to this sort of predatory lending that the SNLs are doing. And that's, I think, since they are the ones who are obligated to give the proper information, they're the professionals here, that I think the avenue is to go through the courts and sue them for malpractice.
Well, that's an interesting one. I like the idea of simply saying, hey, if you wrote the mortgage, then you and the person is defaulting now, and it was a, you know, any of these ninja loans or anything like this, then you now own the house and you have to rent it by law. You have to rent it to the person who's living in it as long as they want at current market rental rates determined by an independent appraiser. And they have the option of buying it back from you when they get on their feet or when they can reasonably. And, you encourage them to take the risk, and you said that you were willing to take the risk. And, of course, most of these mortgage brokers are backed up by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they could rebundle and resell these mortgages. So, really, it was just, you know, a product that they were flipping for a percentage. And, it's your problem. I mean, I think that that's the way we should go. Morgan, thanks for the call. Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Christy, just about a half a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Okay, I've been curious. Ever since we had to bail out Neil Bush's SNL scandal.
Right, Silverado.
I wonder how that guy feels about that.
Well, he said he didn't think that the SNL should have been bailed out either. So I think we have to give him credit for being intellectually consistent and honest, even if he's wrong, in my opinion.
I missed that. I think he's wrong, too.
Yeah.
Totally wrong.
But yeah, your point is well taken.
I'm still furious.
Yeah. Okay. I'm right there with you. It's a good one. Christy, thank you very much for the call. 56 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman program here with you. And coming up in the next hour, Aaron Selbig is going to be with us. He's with KUDO in Anchorage, Alaska. Going to tell us about what's going on. You're not going to believe what's going on in Alaska if you've not been following this. It's like the entire state is melting down in political scandal. It's the Republican Party writ large.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio.
Oil industry has been lining the pockets, we now know, of several of our local politicians. It all started about a year ago with an FBI raid on six current and former Alaska state legislators. A year later, they've had one of those guys go to trial. He was convicted on seven counts of bribery and extortion and money laundering. There's two more that are going to trial here in a couple of weeks. And the main player in this was a guy named Bill Allen, who ran an oil field services company called the Vico Corporation here in Anchorage. And Vico, it's always been known by Alaskans, has kind of been the foot soldiers for the North Slope oil industry, that being British Petroleum, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil. And it turns out that they actually had a room set up in a hotel in Juneau where they were literally handing out bags of cash to state legislators in return for their votes and their influence on their colleagues in the Alaska legislature.
Cash as in $100 bill cash?
Oh, well, you know.
Or as in, here's a campaign contribution.
Actually, maybe more like checks. The campaign contributions is part of it. Vico was always a big campaign contributor, but they were also, you know, taking it a step farther and actually offering cash bribes to some of these legislators. Now, one of the legislators is Ben Stevens, who at the time, a year ago, was the president of the Alaska Senate. Now, if that name sounds familiar to your listeners, it's because he's the son of United States Senator Ted Stevens, who we now know is also being investigated by the Justice Department, along with another of our congressional delegation in Washington, Congressman Don Young. So it goes all the way to the top.
And all three members of your congressional delegation are under investigation in one way or another.
Well, that's mostly true. The other, we only have three members.
Right, two senators and a member of the House
delegation. The other one being Senator Lisa Murkowski. She's not officially under investigation yet, but she had a property deal here in Alaska that was pretty clearly favoritism on the part of a big campaign donor, friend of hers, and she is probably going to be facing a Senate ethics investigation over that, yes.
Aaron, you said pretty definitively that Vico was basically bribing legislators. Has that been determined by a court of law, or is that just an allegation at this point?
No, it's an allegation. It's spelled out in all of the indictments. However, the really damning piece of evidence so far is that Bill Allen, who again was the CEO of Vico, the one who was the foot soldier for the oil industry handing out these bribes, he and his vice president, a fella named Rick Smith, they have pled guilty.
Oh, really?
So we don't have to say alleged to be passing
out these bribes. They actually have pled guilty to it.
Yeah, they're convicted felons. They have copped a plea. Their sentencing is coming up here, and I think in the beginning of October. And, you know, that's what's making all of these dirty politicians, including Ted Stevens and Don Young, nervous, is because their good buddy and their biggest campaign contributor over the years, Bill Allen, has turned state's evidence, and God knows what he's telling the FBI. So, I mean, if you read Bill Allen's indictment, it's pretty clear, you know, what exactly happened. It spelled out how it was planned and how it went down and who was involved. So there's only been one conviction so far. It's the only person that's gone to trial, but it's coming. It's a major storm, a political earthquake, and it's coming.
We're talking with Aaron Selbig of KUDO, KUDO in Anchorage, Alaska. And Aaron, to what extent is the prosecution that's happening in Alaska being initiated or propelled, moved forward by the U.S. attorney in Alaska, these being the political appointees? And was there, and if so, was there any buzz around whether the Alaska U.S. attorney was, you know, on Karl Rove's hit list or was doing a good job or not a good job or whatever, because there, you know, there certainly have been other cases of, at least we know for pretty much for sure that at least one or two of the U.S. attorneys who were dismissed because they were actually investigating Republicans, God forbid.
Right, yeah. You know, I honestly, Tom, I can't really answer that. There's been some scuttlebutt around talk radio and the news media here about, you know, that sort of drama maybe being played out with Alaska's U.S. attorney. But it seems to be that the investigation is primarily being driven from Washington, D.C. There's two grand juries involved in this, one of them here in Anchorage and another in Washington, D.C. The FBI has several agents working on this here in Anchorage and in Washington, D.C. So the, as for the involvement of the U.S. attorney here, I honestly don't know.
So this
maybe
is just,
that'll come out at
this
the
is
end.
Just good old-fashioned professional law enforcement professionals who've probably been there through three different presidential administrations and don't have a political axe to grind doing their jobs.
It's the Justice Department's Office of Public Integrity, and they are conducting investigations like this presently all over the country. I know some of your listeners are probably nodding their heads thinking, yeah, well, Alaska's going through the same thing we're going through. They really have, and to their credit, they have really targeted public officials in the last few years. They're doing this in other states and other municipalities around the country, but it seems like Alaska, it's like they didn't know what they were getting into. When they started poking their nose into how the oil industry affects politics illegally here into the state of Alaska, they opened up a can of worms that they had no idea they were going to get into.
Yeah, apparently.
So it's turned into a vast, vast investigation. For instance, I don't know if you heard about this, but a couple of weeks ago, the FBI raided the home of Ted Stevens here
that made national
down in
news.
Girdwood, just about 40 miles south of Anchorage.
Yeah. So how is this, Aaron, how is this affecting Alaska politics, partisan politics?
Oh, it couldn't be a bigger earthquake. It's an absolute and total upheaval right now. It is the biggest political earthquake that the state of Alaska has ever seen. You've got, for the first time, you know, people talking about running against Ted Stevens and Don Young. I mean, that's just unheard of. Ted Stevens is the longest serving Republican senator in American history. He's considered the godfather of the state. The airport here in Anchorage is named after him, but he is very weak right now. If he even runs next year when his seat is up,
if he's not in jail.
it's just amazing. I mean, we've got a Republican governor, Sarah Palin, who ran last year as all of this tornado was starting to build. She ran on a platform of reforming ethics, of restoring openness and honesty to government. And, you know, she's been successful in that. And now she's got approval ratings in the neighborhood of 90%. So, you know, all these old school, good old boy, GOP, you know, taking bags of money, I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine. Those guys are starting to go the way of the dinosaur here in Alaska.
Like the Republican Party, if you have a Republican governor who's running as squeaky clean, and she actually is, the Republican Party may actually make it through this.
Well, no, you would think so, but the Alaska Republican Party is so entrenched in the way that they've done business, the way that they've gotten away with doing business in this state for decades, that they didn't support Sarah Palin when she ran. They actually actively campaigned against her, and they still don't like her. They want their good old boys in there. They haven't seen the light. They haven't pulled their head out of the sand, and they still don't get it.
Yeah. Well, it all boils down to the old adage that if you don't believe in government, you can't govern effectively.
Right.
And that's, you know, the mantra ever since Reagan, you know, moved the Republican Party hard to the right, is that they don't believe in government. And so they just view it as a honeypot, something that they can, you know, grab all the sweets out of. Aaron Selvig. Aaron, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Aaron, every day on KUDO, 1080 a.m. in Anchorage, Alaska, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
So George Bush says he's got Vietnam all figured out, finally. This is a guy who's been through so many various weird contortions on this issue. Now, let's hear what he said today in a speech to the veterans of foreign wars, just this morning here in a VFW speech. Here's George Bush.
Whatever your position is on that debate, one unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens whose agonies would add to our vocabulary new terms like boat people, re-education camps, and killing fields. There's another price to our withdrawal from Vietnam, and we can hear it in the words of the enemy we face in today's struggle. Those who came to our soil and killed thousands of citizens on September the 11th, 2001.
Oh, wait a minute. Iraq attacked us on 9/11?
An interview with a Pakistani newspaper after the 9/11 attacks.
Oh, Pakistan
attacked us. Declared that the American people had risen against their government's war in Vietnam, and they must do the same today.
Yeah, right. And so George W. Bush, here's some of his previous comments on the topic. Before, I don't know, he started drinking again or something. Back in 2000, August 4th, 2000, George W. Bush said, a generation shaped by Vietnam. Now, keep in mind, this is during the election campaign. It's when he's running for president. The race that he lost, that the Supreme Court handed him after he lost it in Florida. He said, a generation shaped by Vietnam must remember the lessons of Vietnam. When America uses force in the world, the cause must be just, the goal must be clear, and the victory must be overwhelming. This is what he said to the RNC convention. I wasn't at that convention. I was at the 2004 convention. And then in 1999, in his biography, A Charge to Keep, it notes the Republican presidential frontrunner also says he learned the lessons of Vietnam. He says our nation should be slow to engage troops, but when we do so, we must do so with ferocity. We cannot go into a conflict unless we are committed to win. We can never again ask the military to fight a political war. Well, that's Bush actually making sense. Of course, that's before he became president. In April of 2004, he was asked, well, how do you answer the Vietnam comparison? He says, I think the analogy is false. I also happen to think that analogy sends the wrong message to our troops and sends the wrong message to the enemy. That's the analogy that he is now using. This is absolutely bizarre. Keith sends me a note. He says, please speak out against Bush's speech today where he compared withdrawing from Iraq to Vietnam and the withdrawal. He says, I lost a brother in Vietnam in 1974, and I grieve him every day. How many hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis have been slaughtered in Iraq because of this occupation? How many mothers grieve their children? Where has the media coverage been on the disgusting, despicable, deploring conditions the Iraqis have not been killed, have been living in over the past 4 years? Where's the president's concern been with and for them? To compare this with the withdrawal of Vietnam, especially since we all pride ourselves in being intellectually honest and know that Bush got through his father into the elite Texas Air National Guard and then skipped out, went AWOL. This is terrible. He says, this speech disgusted me and really made me sad. None of us want to see the continued slaughter of the Iraqi people. Well said, Keith. Thank you. And that's what's going on. The ongoing slaughter of the Iraqi people, first by us and now by the Iraqi people themselves. And George W. Bush has opened the gates of hell in the Middle East. And you look back at why, and you find that there was this confluence of forces. You had Bush himself in 1999 telling his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, telling this guy, as the guy who wrote the first draft of A Charge to Keep, Bush's autobiography that was written for him by two different ghostwriters. This was the first of the two ghostwriters, Mickey Herskowitz. Bush is talking to him in 1999, before he's even running for president. They're preparing to position him. Karl Rove has already outmaneuvered Jeb Bush, because the Bush family and the Republicans thought Jeb Bush was going to be the Bush who was going to run for president in 2000. They didn't reckon with Karl Rove. And this is why Jeb Bush signed the Project for New American Century letter to Bill Clinton in 1998, saying, bomb Iraq now. In any case, George Bush says to Mickey Herskowitz, he says, you know, my father had all this political capital when he was in Vietnam, and he but, you know, basically, I don't have the entire quote in front of me. My computer has it. Cindy Sheehan actually reading it. But the bottom line was, he said, you know, his dad blew it by getting out of Iraq. Excuse me, did I say Vietnam? Getting out of Iraq too fast. That if, and it's true, by the way, if George Bush Sr., and politically true, if George Bush Sr. had extended the war in Iraq, had figured out a way to, instead of having a 100-hour war, had a 100-day war or a 6-month war so that it ran up to the presidential election, he probably would have won the election. Because that's the kind of power a president has during wartime. People rally. It's just a natural thing to rally around the president, rally around the leaders during a time of war. And Bush knew that. And he said, if I become president, if I have an ability to attack Iraq, I'm going to do it, Bush said, and have a successful presidency and get past all my programs to privatize Social Security and turn America basically over to corporations and run the government like he was the first CEO president. Run the government like a corporation. Corporations are kingdoms, they're not democracies. Well, Bush is running it like a corporation, I guess. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Yeah, don't be afraid. I'm telling you, we have seen worse in this country. We had a civil war in this country, and we made it through. We're going to make it through this one, too. And the fact that this program is on, the fact that there's websites all over the place that are talking about these issues, the fact that the American people are waking up, it should all be great signs of encouragement. By the way, speaking of Alaska, just to wrap up our topic from the beginning of the hour, over at Brad Friedman's blog, bradblog.com, He's pointing out how, I'll just share a couple sentences from it. The state of Alaska has been fighting tooth and nail to keep from releasing their database of how voters voted back in 2004, and now they're at it again. Despite a court order, and the bottom line of this is that Lisa Murkowski, the daughter of the former governor, who is now the U.S. Senator from Alaska, might not have even been actually elected in the 2006 election. The Democratic Party suing for the databases from the voting machines, because they found that there were hundreds, when they looked at the 2004 database, as a result of a court order in July of 2006, they finally got the 2004 database, and they found it had hundreds of edits after the election. And they, as far as I know, they still don't have the 2006 database. And what they do know is that in some districts, the voter turnout was 200% higher than the number of registered voters. Pretty bizarre. You can read all about it over at Brad Friedman's blog, bradblog.com. And this interesting little tidbit, just going into the Wayback Machine here, this goes back a few months, but nonetheless it's worth revisiting. NPR reporting, and a tip of the hat to the folks in our chat room who share this with me. The Bush administration has taken full advantage of a Patriot Act provision that permits interim appointments of United States attorneys without Senate confirmation of federal prosecutors now on the job. 21 of 93 did not face Senate confirmation. It's grim. 866-303-2270, but we'll make it better, right? 866-303-2270, our telephone number, airamerica.com. Participate in our blog. I'm blogging on the homepage of airamerica.com as well as over at the Tom Hartman page. And also you'll find links there to our live chat room, and you'll find links over to tomhartman.com where our message board is and a compilation of articles that I've written and all my books and all that other junk, you know, all the good stuff there. Pat in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. You said something earlier that I found quite interesting. You know, George Bush, as CEO of this country, he was, governors are generally considered CEOs of their states. The one thing that he did with Texas is that he let a lot of the things that Governor Ann Richards put in place, he didn't touch them, and that's why he didn't destroy Texas like he did every time he was in a CEO position of many of these corporations.
Right, yeah, he was a pretty lousy CEO for his various companies, Armbusto and whatnot. But also, Texas has a weak governor. That's the governor has very, very, very limited powers in the state of Texas, unlike
that's
most
true
states. And,
that's true. Yeah. The lieutenant governor has more power than the governor.
Right, and the Speaker of the House, the head of the legislature, has more power than the governor as well. I remember when, and Pat, thanks for the call and for pointing that out. I remember when Bush first started, you know, when he was appointed by the Supreme Court to be president of the United States, and he said, you know, Dick Cheney and I, we're going to be the first CEO presidents. We're the first two guys who are not lawyers. We've got degrees in business, and we're going to run this country like a corporation. And I remember thinking, what? A corporation is a kingdom. It is a legally enacted kingdom. If you are the principal stockholder and the CEO of a corporation, for all practical purposes, you are a king. You can fire people at will. You can snoop on them. You know, the people give up their First Amendment right of free speech when they come to work for you. They give up their Fourth Amendment right of privacy. They give up their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination and certain levels of taking. They give up... within the context of their performance within in the workplace, they give up their Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendment rights to a fair and speedy trial by a jury of their peers and the right to make bail. I mean, basically, a corporation is a kingdom. That's not to say it's a terrible thing, but it's a reality. And Bush says he's going to run our country like a corporation. And as I said, he is. And that's the tragedy. Nikki in Newark, New Jersey. Hey, Nikki.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. I really love a lot of what you say, and I certainly don't agree with your first guest this afternoon, but I have to say, as someone who for the past 3 years now has been doing the types of steps that I need to do, reducing my credit, my husband and I, reducing our credit burden to zero, saving up that down payment because we didn't want any of these zero down payment mortgages, and waiting because the home prices were just outside of our range and more than we felt comfortable with paying a mortgage. Why now should I feel like I kind of have, with all of this talk about trying to bail people out, because I know that we're not going to be able to bail out the people that I might really be interested in bailing out without being able to bail out these banks as well. And it just seems to me, and there are a lot of people, I don't want to bail them out because they didn't do the right thing, didn't do the due diligence. I mean, as far as, well, they can't understand the writing. Neither could I, but I know that factored into whatever I would spend to purchase a home would be the price of getting an attorney, someone who could figure out that kind of thing for me.
Yeah.
So why?
I understand, Nikki, and to some extent I share your ambivalence, and that's why I would not be an advocate of a program that literally bailed people out, that said, okay, you made a bad decision, here's some money, which is what we did with the SNLs, by the way, back during the last Bush administration. Well, only we didn't do it for the people, we did it to the bankers, the guys like Neil Bush. But to we have in this country, the only reason why you are going to be able to get a mortgage, the only reason why I've been able to get mortgages in my life, And the reason why we have such wide home ownership in the United States right now as compared with 1915 when home ownership rates were less than 10%. I mean, we're very, very low. Historically, home ownership outside of family farms has been very low in the United States. But we've been a nation of renters. Is because in the 1930s, the federal government brought into existence basically a backup institution, you know, Fannie Mae, that would back up banks and say, if your mortgages go south, we will buy them. We'll take care of it. Don't worry. Don't, you know, go ahead and loan money. But do it within rational guidelines. But we're there to back you up. And then there was a further expansion of that with Freddie Mac. And then there was actually probably the largest expansion of that was the Veterans Bill, you know, the GI yeah. Bill after World War II. And again, the Veterans Administration, all these VA, my dad got one, you know, a VA-backed mortgage.
My uncle got one after Vietnam.
Right, and all of these were arguably bailouts. I mean, they were the government saying, we're going to distort the marketplace in a way that makes it possible for a person who typically would not be able to get a mortgage to get a mortgage. And I'm talking about somebody who's got a good job and is putting down 5, 10, 20% down payment. That even isn't enough for a small bank to take that kind of risk, and wasn't back in 1910. And so I think that there's some rational middle ground here where if we can say, okay, we're going to create a fund and we're going to use this fund to give people some breathing time and some bridge time. And, you know, if they end up bailing out or if they end up, you know, walking away from it, we're not going to, you know, give them the cash and say, you know, good luck or whatever. We're not going to buy their houses for them. But I really believe and I've seen it. I mean, I've seen it in, you know, people that I work with that, you know, they go in and they talk to mortgage brokers and they get this whole song and dance about how everything's going to be wonderful and don't worry about a thing, and they get the paperwork and they don't know how to read it, and it really is legalese and lawyers don't know how to read it, and you know, bingo, they're caught, and they've been expecting the housing market to go up forever. And I realize it's a stupid, naive expectation. I guess
I'm kind of frustrated because, I mean, living in the Northeast, I live in the New York City commuting area.
Mm-hmm.
So unless I go way out to almost Pennsylvania, which is going to have me doing a four-hour commute, and then, you know, I'll never see my son, you know, I just, for the past 2 years that we've been involved in this process of trying to get ourselves together to buy a home, part of the reason I haven't been able to get one up to now is because of these people that have been engaging in these risky procedures on, I mean, it,
right. It's been driving up the market.
They were hoping that, you know, things, the market could continue to rise, they'd be able to refinance, they'd be able to do these other things, and they're part of the reason why I've been waiting so long.
No, I understand and I agree, and there's a correction that's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to be substantial, in my opinion, and ultimately a good thing. And in fact, Louise and I were talking about this the other day, that there's all these McMansions out there. You know, people who are living in 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square foot houses.
Yeah.
That if you go back and you look at what happened during the Great Depression, I mean, you look at in New York City, for example, all the brownstones. You know, you go off any of these side streets, you know, off any of the major avenues in Midtown, and these brownstones that are now walk-up apartments. They've been turned into apartment buildings.
Right.
They were originally single-family homes.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, during the Depression, people couldn't afford to have that big a single-family home anymore, and they started converting homes from the brownstones in New York to the, you know, the big old houses in any city in America, started converting them into multi-room rental properties. And I'm guessing that 10 years from now, we're going to see probably half the McMansions in America are going to be rental properties, as opposed to single-family homes, because there's going to have to be a downsizing, because we have, you know, Bush has run us into debt, we've got our trade debt, and now we've got this housing debt. Nikki, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks, Tom, and keep up the good work.
You too, and thanks for making a good point, and good luck. You know, it's extraordinary. It's a fine thing that people are fiscally responsible, and I absolutely support it. 45 minutes past the hour.
There's a superstore out by the interstate. I get my shirts and my tires and my eggs in one place. I guess it's convenient. It is what it is. We save a few dollars, but what is the cost? When they don't know your name, seems like something is lost. I dream of a world that's not all the same, where a man with a vision can still make his way, where the middle guy says to the big boys, you can't shut me down. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Actually, I'm in one right now, sort of. I don't know, there's really not a serious competitor to the New York Times. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Wendy Wang on the line with us at the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Wendy.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am just great, but I'll get better. What's up in Washington, D.C., and what's going on in the world?
You know, we're reflecting on what the president had said earlier about how we should look at the war in Iraq and compare it historically to the war in Korea and Vietnam, and how he is standing firm on his position to stay the course, it seems like. And, of course, everyone is also talking under the breath about al-Maliki's reaction to his speech yesterday in terms of how he feels that the al-Maliki government isn't doing much to reconcile this sectarian divide within Iraq.
Now, if my understanding is correct from the news reports that I read, al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, yesterday
correct.
Said, we can find other friends, we don't need America.
Exactly. It's kind of a blow to this president, and today the White House is kind of backtracking on the president's remarks, saying, of course, that the prime minister knows how the president, or knows where the president stands, and for whatever reason, that didn't come across in his speech.
Wow. This reminds me, who was the president of Nasser, wasn't it? The president of Egypt who basically told us to take a leap and and created a strategic alliance with the Soviet Union?
We're not friends with many of the Middle Eastern countries in the world.
Yeah, yeah, and then you know, and then that ultimately changed. But I mean, it's wow. But well, I mean, just consider the last week, and it astounds me, Wendy, how poorly this has been covered by the mainstream media. You have al-Maliki, who is the prime minister, the democratically elected prime minister of Iraq, going to Iran, and meeting with Ahmadinejad, and they're calling each other good friends and walking around holding hands, literally walking around holding hands.
Exactly.
And although that's a fairly common thing that men do in the Middle East, and so, you know, it doesn't have any extraordinary significance beyond the fact that they're being friendly.
Friendly, yes.
And then he goes to Syria, and he's talking with folks in Syria, and it's like it's almost like we're pretending it's not happening. And then he says, oh, and you know, if George doesn't like the way that we're doing things, we can find other friends. And it's like the Iraqi prime minister is, in a way it seems, standing up and being independent and nationalist, which is what we have been saying for 5 years we want the Iraqi government to do, but we don't seem to like it when they do it.
Al-Maliki has got a point. He was elected by the Iraqi people, which we supported in the elections that we've sent out military folks to protect from insurgent attacks, whatnot. And he was elected by that body of people, and he is an independent government. And, you know, he has many good points that this president cannot refute. And for this president to say that they're going to issue benchmarks for the al-Maliki government, it seems to give the impression that al-Maliki would be under the U.S. thumb, which is an impression he does not want to leave his Middle Eastern neighbors.
Right, or his constituents.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, something else that is not covered very much by the mainstream media, we're looking at an issue of Iraqi reconstruction, corruption scandal, and this is by an army contracting officer by the name of Major John Crockham, and it looks like he had filtered some millions and millions of dollars through a Trans-Orient General Trading Post in Kuwait, and he's issuing all kinds of contracts to these illicit companies and giving out contracts left and right in U.S. taxpayer dollars for contracts such as drinking water. And we have all heard about just how good the drinking water is in Iran.
Yeah, I thought Halliburton's Cayman Islands offshore company was getting a lot of the drinking water contracts that they were supplying.
We're hearing it looks like there's other companies who may be dipping into the same pond as well. And we hope to hear more of this when the Congress comes back into session.
Is this, do you think, Wendy Wang, do you think that this is going to be kind of like the Teapot Dome scandal where Albert Fall or Fell, I think it was Albert Fall was his name, the Secretary of the Interior, took a bribe to give a gas lease on the, you know, Teapot Dome in Wyoming. You know, is this the same kind of thing going on?
You know, it's funny when the president evokes history, all kinds of historical parallels can be conjured up. I don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, it does smell kind of like that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, although this guy isn't quite as high as a cabinet official, but it'd be interesting to see how high up this does go. Any further word on what the Senate might do, Pat Leahy in particular, but I guess Arlen Specter as well, when they come back into session with regard to the Bush administration's failure to meet their subpoenas for information on a variety of things?
Well, you know, it's going to be so interesting to see just how much power this Congress still can wield because of the amount of power the executive branch has taken away in the last 6 years. So you're going to be wondering just what kind of reprimand would the Congress issue out to the White House, if any, and can they really take any enforcement against those who disregard the congressional subpoenas that came down that this president is so gung-ho about ignoring? It is a crisis of constitutional power, the balances of power between the executive and the legislative branch, and it kind of makes me personally slightly nervous to just find out where we are today.
Yeah, it's
scary.
Yeah, well, in a way, yeah, it is. I think that we all need to be contacting our elected representatives and saying, don't worry, guys, we've got your back. Stand up, be strong, don't be afraid of these bullies.
I agree.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree.
Wendy Wang, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up next, the Knights Templar.
This This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
6 minutes past the hour, and sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes, as the Fireside Theater is fond of pointing out,
you know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be that pirates were associated with the Knights Templar? And by the way, don't ever go to the website, KnightsTemplar.com. Very dangerous website. With us, archaeologist, explorer, and author, David Childress. His website, AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com, and his book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, were the Mavericks, Sea Captains, members of the Knights Templar, and the Freemasons. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom.
Were they?
Were the Knights Templar, wait, the Olmecs? What?
Yeah.
You were talking about the Olmecs, and now, yeah, the Knights Templar.
I think that's your most recent book, right, The Mystery of the Olmecs?
The Mystery of the Olmecs, yeah. Right. And, yeah. And yeah, we're talking about my other book, Pirates and the Lost Templar Fleet.
Ah, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's the one that came out about, right. That was just out about 5 years. But that book, yes, I do maintain in that book that the Jolly Roger is a Masonic Knights Templar symbol.
Wait a minute, you mean the skull and crossbones?
That's right. Yeah, the whole skull and crossbones, very much a Knights Templar and a Masonic symbol. Most symbolism used by pirates was Masonic Templar symbology.
Does this have anything to do with the Skull and Bones Society at Yale, by the way?
Well,
do you think that they got some of their stuff?
Sure, they've taken their skull and bones symbolism from the early pirates. You see, the early pirates are the Lost Templar fleet. After the Templars were suppressed in 1307.
They weren't just suppressed, they were declared illegal by the Pope, and they were ordered to be put to death wherever they were found.
Well, that's right. And then finally the execution of Jacques de Molay and stuff like that. But what happened was that Templars at that time had the largest fleet of ships in the world. Mm-hmm. And they were based principally out of a port in southern France called La Rochelle. But the Templar fleet...
And also out of Malta. Weren't they big in Malta?
You know what? They were partly in Malta, but people often confuse the Knights of Malta with the Knights Templar, and they're not the same thing.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, the Knights of Malta are more allied with the Vatican and the Pope, while the Knights Templar, as we all know, were really, in a sense, the enemies of the Pope. And they became more so, of course, once they were suppressed, and that's where the pirates came in. This Templar fleet that was in the Mediterranean and in the Atlantic, it like literally vanished overnight, and much
when?
Of it. Right. What happened?
Was this in the early 1600s?
Early 1300s.
Early 1300s. Right after the suppression of the Templars.
That's right. And
right.
And by the way, too, for your listeners, the whole stigma of Friday the 13th. That's the day the Templars were suppressed in 1307. It was Friday the 13th, October 13th, 1307. And that became this unlucky day. The Templar fleet split up really into three different parts. Part of it went up to Scotland, and it became the Navy of Scotland. And this is a lot where the Sinclair family comes in, the famous Roslyn Chapel that's in Scotland, that's part of the Da Vinci Code story. Part of the Templar fleet went to Portugal and became the Knights of Christ, and they became Portugal's navy and Sir Henry the Navigator. Part of the Templar fleet was kept around Sicily, and at the time, Sicily and southern Italy were ruled by two French Templar kings, and their name was Roger the First and Roger the Second. And that's where the whole term of Jolly Roger comes from.
Amazing. Now, this was pre-Medici family or post?
I'm
lousy with my Italian history, but
and
church history, Catholic
history.
The
history of Italy at that time is very complicated because Italy wasn't a country at the time. It was a bunch of small city-states, much like Germany was at that time.
Ruled in large part by the Vatican.
Right. And, you know, the whole thing... So, one of the other things that happened that created the Templar fleet and pirates associated with them was in 1493, the Pope, this is 1 year after Columbus had been to the Caribbean and back,
mm-hmm.
The Pope then, because of a Portuguese explorer having been blown across the Atlantic and landing in Brazil, the Portuguese went to the Pope with the Spanish, and they said, hey, we found this other land across the Atlantic, too. And the Spanish said, no, we've claimed all that. The Pope, in 1493, then divided the New World between Spain and Portugal. In 1493, okay, and there's a...
This is why they speak Portuguese in Brazil right now?
Well, that's right, and that's exactly why Brazil was created. But Spain got the rest of the New World.
Right.
Now, this was a problem for other countries. France, Germany, Holland, England, Scotland, Scandinavian countries. The Pope didn't leave anything for them. Every island in the Caribbean, all of North America, most of South America, except for what the Portuguese were going to claim, was all for the Spanish. Now, foreign countries didn't go for that. And what happened was they prayed with this, particularly a Templar fleet, and they're flying. I mean, they're now outlawed. The Templars would then... And these pirates, and later some of these guys became privateers. They were actually in contract with governments to go out.
They're essentially mercenary Marine Corps.
That's right, and so
or naval
they
corps.
And what these Templar fleet would do, and I mean these guys were former Templars, but now even a couple hundred years had passed, so they were still in many cases now they were French guys who had relocated to Scotland and stuff like that. But they roamed the Atlantic mainly, and then in the end, all over the Caribbean and even into the Pacific. And what they did was they preyed on Spanish ships that were, and Portuguese too, that were aligned with the Vatican. I mean, it was a war. It was a naval war against the Pope.
So this was like the Catholics versus the Catholics for 500 years. It's amazing. We're talking with David Childress, AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com, the best place to find his books. We're talking about his book, Pirates and the Lost Templar Fleet. He also wrote The Mystery of the Olmecs, which we talked about some months ago, as I recall. David, bring us to today. What's the significance of all of this to us here living in the United States in 2007?
That's a good question. Pirates are especially sort of... dear to Americans. Americans love pirates. And, pirates in other countries, pirates are totally feared. They're bad guys. But in America, pirates are actually kind of good guys. At least some of them are. And the reason
we love our pirate movies.
Yeah, that's real. We love our pirate movies. And in fact, this is so interesting. See, when America declared independence of Britain, we had no navy. What Britain had was a huge, huge navy. I mean, they...
Biggest in the world.
That's right. And it's often been said that the country with the biggest navy rules the world. For a while, it was Holland. Holland had the biggest navy. They ruled the world for a while. Spain had the biggest navy for a while. Finally, it was England had the biggest navy. They ruled the world. America, in the whole Revolutionary War... America's advantage was guerrilla warfare. One of the things about the United States at the time, there was no special capital or the British couldn't just go and take one city and the war would be over. It wasn't like that. The Americans lived all over in the forests and the rivers and running around. But what America didn't have was a navy. They had no navy at all. And what the early forefathers of America, and these were all like Masonic Templar guys too,
right.
George Washington,
sure.
All these guys.
Washington's inauguration was a Masonic
ritual. That's right,
and
if you
ritual.
Look at Washington's Masonic apron, there's a picture of it in my book, what's on his apron? A skull and crossbones. Okay, that is Because that's
the founding of America with a skull and cross.
That's right. I mean, America's early Navy was a pirate Navy, and our Navy flew the skull and crossbones. Although, I mean, once we created Old Glory, I mean, our American Navy flew that flag.
Sure.
You know, but so what? And in fact, the early founding fathers of the American Navy were pirates. Jean Lafitte is so famous for that.
And today they have morphed into, well, you know, a lot of people have borrowed from, I suppose, from the Masonic traditions, from the Mormons to the modern Masonic. The Masons are still around.
Catholics are not allowed to become Masons.
Interesting.
That's the Pope.
Yep. There you go. David Childress, AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com for his book, Pirates and the Lost Templar Fleet. David, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott on the line with us, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, one of the very best websites out there for veterans issues. And if you know a vet, are a vet, related to a vet, let them know about the website, VAWatchdog.org. Larry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you again, Tom. And if you are a vet or related to a vet, that makes you about 1 in 25% of the American population, believe that or not.
1 in 4 or 25%.
Yeah. I'm sorry, 1 in 4. Yeah, 1 in 4 of the American population is either a veteran or directly related to a veteran and, therefore, can qualify for some type of VA benefits. But that's a whole other story.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Up at the top of your, you've got a whole bunch of things on the website. First, let me just toss it to you first. What do you see as the major story? There's a couple that are piquing my interest, but I'm curious what you're really hot about right now.
The real big story of the morning is President Bush speaking to the VFW convention in Kansas City, because we have a complete change in attitude and in verbiage from the White House about justification for the Iraq War. As you know, many people said the Iraq War is turning into a Vietnam, and the White House has been very, very quiet on this. You never heard them use Vietnam and Iraq in the same sentence until today. This was thrust number one of a two-part program they put in place. It was a speech today before the VFW. Next Tuesday, we'll get a speech from the president before the American Legion Convention in Reno. And the justification now is, you're right, we don't want another Vietnam. And these are the president's exact words. One unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens whose agonies would add to our vocabulary new terms like boat people, re-education camps, and killing fields.
Yeah, we played the audio on that about an hour ago.
And what the president is saying here, and this is a totally new tack, is you're right, we don't want another Vietnam. That's why we're going to stay in Iraq. This whole new philosophy is going to be expanded next week, as I mentioned in a speech on Tuesday. This is absolutely amazing. The criticism is coming from every which direction, as you might imagine. I saw David Gergen, the former White House press secretary, on CNN a little while ago, and he said it's just astounding that the president would even mention Vietnam in the same sentence or to try to use it as a justification. But there are those who agree with that and those who disagree.
Well, how can a guy who went AWOL during the Vietnam War, I mean, literally, absent, you know, who deserted, actually, I guess you're only AWOL for the first 30 days, and then after that you're a deserter, who deserted during the Vietnam War, be talking about Vietnam? I mean,
well,
why are they just not? I mean, if this had been Al Gore or Bill Clinton, they hellfire would be raining down in his head right now.
Well, there is going to be some hellfire on this, but I think we have to remember that the president doesn't make this policy or set this policy. He has policymakers who do this for him, and somewhere deep in the background, whether this is coming from the Pentagon or coming from the various think tanks, we don't know, although we'll probably find out shortly. And that is, what he's doing is he is just laying down a new policy. All right? Yeah. And this was very well accepted at the VFW convention. I would imagine it will also be well accepted by the American Legion come next week.
Larry, when we left Vietnam, there was some score settling, and there were re-education camps, and there were people who tried to flee Vietnam. But we killed, during the Vietnam War, conservatively, 2 million Vietnamese, and some historians suggest as more than 3 million Vietnamese. And I think the broad consensus is that within 6 months of the time that we left Vietnam, by and large, there was no more killing going on in Vietnam, and that even the killing that happened after we left was at a lower level of killing than what was going on as a consequence of our being there. And so, and now Vietnam's a trading partner of ours. I mean, am I going way out on a limb here by saying that maybe the lesson that we should learn from Vietnam is get out while, you know, as quickly as you can and don't make the mistake of hanging around?
That's the lesson that many people have been saying. But what is interesting here, Tom, is that you're going to find those who agree with the president's new argument. Remember, there are many veterans who say we never should have gone into Vietnam, we couldn't have won it, and it's good we got out. But there are still many in the veterans community, and I'm speaking for veterans now, not the civilian community, but many in the veterans community who feel that the military was never given the proper weapons or the proper orders to fight communism in Southeast Asia, especially in Vietnam. They feel that pulling out was the wrong thing to do, and you'll still find commentators today. Colonel Ollie North is a prime example of this, who will tell you to your face, we won the war in Vietnam on the battlefields, but we lost it in the media and on the campuses. Okay, it is a difference of opinion, but what we're left with is we're left with history, and we didn't win that war. We can't go back and refight it. But what's interesting now is the White House wants to pull this out and turn around a negative argument and try to make it a positive argument.
And once again divide the American people among themselves and get us fighting with each other.
I certainly hope not anymore, Tom.
Yeah, well, but that's what's going to happen inevitably. We're gonna revisit the Vietnam debate all over again. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Thanks, Larry, for being with us today.
Take care, Tom. Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
We need to be taking better care of it. The topic of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. Just let me encourage you again to get out there and check it out. It's just an amazing movie. Friday, I'll be in San Francisco doing a Q&A after the screening in San Francisco. You can get the information on that over at tomhartman.com. Go to my schedule page, and you'll find that. I'm in New York right now. We're heading back to Portland right now, or this afternoon. So, by the way, just a quick heads up to our listeners in Portland listening on KPOJ, M620 KPOJ. C-SPAN has their book bus in Portland today. It's at Powell's at Hawthorne. And those of you who live in Portland know what I'm talking about, Powell's Bookstore in Hawthorne. So show up and say hi. Drop by and say hi. And I got an email here from John who says, today you said not to go to the Knights Templar website because it's dangerous. However, you don't say why it's dangerous when you don't explain. He's all freaked out is the bottom line. So, John, lighten up. KnightsTemplar.com will take you to my website. So there you go. I spill the beans. Larry Johnson is with us, formerly of the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. State Department, and his blog right now, NoQuarterUSA.net. Larry Johnson. Larry, welcome to the program.
Tom, good afternoon.
Great to have you back on with us, Larry. I immediately thought of you when the story about George Tenet came up, that basically the Bush administration, it looks to me like they're trying to play pin the tail on the donkey here. George Tenet actually had a boss, as I recall, whose name was George W. Bush, at least during 2001. And well, you know, give us your take on what's going on. Actually, first of all, why don't you summarize for us what's being said right now, first of all, about George Tenet and 9/11?
The report, which was written by John Helgerson, former deputy director of intelligence back when I was there, is a review of who did what or should have done what out of CIA, and it indicts the senior leadership at CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, for failing to take a strategic view, for failing to prioritize resources, for failing to organize those resources in a fashion to accomplish the task that they said was ostensibly so vital. And I've got to tell you, I think this is a remarkable report, because what they did is, normally out of CIA, the lower-level officers are the ones who get blamed. The upper-level officers always skate. Our motto was, officers out there eat first and eat often.
Yeah. Well, it seems to be true in the military as well.
Yeah, but, well, in the Marines, their motto is, officers eat last. And in my experience, that's usually been the case. But here they really, for once, go after George Tenet, John McLaughlin, Jim Pavitt, who was the director of operations, Copher Black, who is the director of the Counterterrorism Center, and I think the criticisms are both measured and appropriate. It doesn't absolve George Bush of his failings, but what it does point out is that the Central Intelligence Agency was in a position to do a lot of things that they failed to do. You know, for example, George Tenet declared in December of 98 that they were at war. They needed to go on a war footing. Yet, what he did is he didn't put anybody in charge of going after bin Laden. The person who was in charge, Michael Schurer, was a second-rate analyst out of the European division. He's publishing books under the name of Anonymous.
Right.
He surrounded himself with analysts who came out of the Soviet division. They were all women. I'm not knocking women, but I'm just saying they called him Charlie Manson. And so surrounded by women who had no experience with Islamic affairs, no background in Arabic, and yet these were the top people fighting bin Laden. And
now what about Richard Clark's role in all of this? Because, you know, my take from what I've read of the report seems that it somewhat contradicts Richard Clark's account that the guys in the CIA were running around with their hair on. Well, actually, he was National Security Administrator. Well, correct me.
He was at the National Security Council with the responsibility for the coordinating counterterrorism and
with the CIA.
For the White House.
Right, but so, I mean, but coordinating with the CIA for the White House through the National Security Council. Right.
But Clark, you know, this doesn't contradict Clark at all. I mean, again, it goes back to, did the CIA take the resources that it had available and use them appropriately? This report says no. Did the CIA have information that should have been shared with other agencies? It says, yes, it did, and they didn't do it. I know from another friend of mine who was an FBI agent assigned out at the Counterterrorism Center, he said that there was just, you know, clear animosity by some mid-level people like Michael Schur against the FBI, refusing to share information, and the bosses did not get in the middle of that, didn't intervene and require that everybody work and play well together.
Now, I had a conversation with Sandy Berger a couple of years ago where he said that when the handover happened in 2001 from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration, he said to Connie Rice, it was Connie Rice who became Secretary of State right off, wasn't it?
No, she was the National Security Advisor.
Yeah, exactly, the National Security Advisor, which was his job. He said to Condoleezza Rice, and it was his understanding that Al Gore said to Dick Cheney and that George Bush was told the same thing by Bill Clinton, that your number one priority has to be Osama bin Laden because he's coming to get us. And he was essentially dismissed by Condoleezza Rice. And was essentially told that anything that the Clinton administration was doing, the Bush administration was going to do the opposite or do something different, that they had other fish to fry, and that early on the word had come down. I mean, you know, Dick Cheney had been put in charge of the counterterrorism task force, and it never met until September of 2001. And although his energy task force was meeting like crazy to carve up the oil fields in Iraq back in March and April of 2001. And that the Bush administration had even gone so far as to say, let's back off on all these investigations of these Saudis. Why are you picking on these Saudis here in the United States and elsewhere? How does this play into this, and is this mentioned in this report?
Well, no, because this report focuses only on what CIA personnel and divisions
it could have done, should have done, had the ability to do. It doesn't look outside of the agency into the National Security Council or into the State Department or into the Department of Defense.
It's or into the White House.
Or the White House. Now, if we, let's take a very clear example. George Tenet writes in his book that the lights were blinking red in the summer of 2001, that he grabbed Kofor Black, took Kofor Black down to brief Condoleezza Rice, and she absolutely refused to react, which is, you know, in concert with what you've been talking about. However, what did George Tenet do in response to that? He did nothing. If he was so convinced that the lights were blinking red, because he met usually on a morning basis with George Bush, the president, it was incumbent upon George Tenet to warn the president. He didn't do that. When the famous August 6, 2001 PDB was delivered to George Bush that bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States, again, George Tenet didn't deliver that and did not take opportunity of that delivery.
But he did send a special guy down just to be there with that. And this guy, George Bush, famously patted on the knee and said, okay, you've covered your butt, or you covered your ass, I guess is the phrase.
They went back to the old style of there were always PDB briefers available on vacations. But I'm saying that George Tenet, as leader, had a chance to do this. So what this report highlights is that at least was the White House some room to say, gee, they didn't tell us.
Right.
Now, the fact of the matter is, as you've rightly pointed out, the White House had no interest whatsoever in doing anything about counterterrorism until 9/11. But this report, I think, is important in that it really highlights that there are 60 individuals identified in the report by name who had a shortcoming that the IG said there should be some review of their conduct and possible punishment. And to date, nobody's punished anybody.
Well, George Tenet got a Medal of Freedom.
He got the Medal of Freedom. Now, some of my other friends who are still in senior positions think that Hayden finally, you know, Hayden takes some delight in releasing this because, as is pointed out in the report, Tenet is criticized for not getting in the middle of a dispute between CIA and the NSA, which Michael Hayden headed at the time.
Right.
But the friends also point out to me that the problems that are identified in this report, the lack of strategic vision, the lack of a strategic analysis, that continues today under Michael Hayden. It has not been corrected. So those problems persist.
So the carry-home message from this is, first of all, that it's only looking at CIA. It's not looking
Correct.
At the broader picture within the administration. And
exactly.
And probably nobody will do that as long as this administration's in power. Secondly, it's identifying specific problems in the CIA that have not been fixed. Wasn't this report actually prepared some time ago?
Yeah, this is 2 years old.
And so in those 2 years, nothing has been done?
Yeah. So this the Democratic Congress is pushing to get this released. Now we'll see if they do anything with it. I sure hope they do.
But presumably the Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, both, who were on the intelligence committees 2 years ago, knew about this, did they not?
Yes, that's exactly correct.
And yet nothing has been done. Well, is it the job of Congress to do something about reordering the CIA, or is micromanaging the CIA something that should happen within the executive branch that it's a part of?
Well, I think it really falls more on the executive branch. In fact, what Congress did to deal with the problems that are identified in this report, they created a new agency, the National Counterterrorism Center. But as you read the IG's report, the problem that led to 9/11 was not the lack of a new bureaucracy, not the lack of more bureaucrats. It was a problem of failure of leadership to use existing resources and capabilities in the right way.
Right. And instead we get, you know, brand new laws that take away our constitutional rights and continuing incompetence, apparently. Larry Johnson, his website, noquarterusa.net, out on web. Check it out. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. Always a pleasure having you here. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, the loonies are at it, and they really do want to make the world on fire here. John Bolton, our former ambassador to the United Nations, on Fox News. The question from Mr. Hemmer, the questioner on Fox News. He says, one final step here, too, that I want to take with you. You told one of our producers earlier today that you don't know if it's true, and you've made clear in our interview here you don't know what the odds are for or against that, but you hope it's true. What they're talking about is that the United States within 6 months will bomb Iran. Why do you hope it's true? Bolton, absolutely. I hope Iran understands that we are very serious, that we are determined they are not going to get a nuclear weapon capability unless they change the strategic decisions they've been pursuing for close to 20 years, that's something they better factor into their calculations. John Bolton, I absolutely hope the U.S. will attack Iran in the next 6 months. In saying this, by the way, as they point out over at the Center for American Progress blog, Think Progress, Bolton has joined other neocons like Bill Kristol, Michael Rubin, in saying that this is what we should do. On the other hand, you've got General Peter Pace in the National Intelligence Estimates saying Iran is, quote, not likely, end quote, to be a major driver of the violence in Iraq. They don't have much to do with it at all. Cynthia, in Diamond Bar, California, you wanted to correct something about al-Maliki and my conversation with Wendy Wang.
Yes, I do. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, you, in speaking to Wendy Wang, you mentioned that al-Maliki was elected in the rigged, U.S. rigged Iraqi elections, but people forget, they can't keep track of one Bush lie after another. Al-Jafari was the so-called elected prime minister, but he fell out of favor because he failed to do the bidding of the Bush regime, and he was replaced by al-Maliki, who I believe may have been a member of the parliament. So no, al-Maliki was not the elected prime minister, even under the rigged elections, and they were rigged. Another thing I wanted to bring up to you is the fact that you keep excusing the Democrats. The Democrats have put on a lot of dog and pony show investigations, but they have not stood up to the plate or exercised their right under the Constitution to hold these war criminals accountable, and I doubt whether they will. We already know what Peter Pace is going to say. Hillary Clinton is out there saying to the Veterans of Foreign Wars that, oh, yes, the surge is working in Al-Anbar province, which was the site of the biggest genocide in the city of Fallujah.
Yeah.
What the American military have been sent to do is to murder.
Yeah, Cynthia, I get it, and I echo your sentiments.
And kick them out. I'm sorry. The Democrats, the cowardly Dems have got to go.
Yes, well said. And let's replace them with some non-cowardly Dems. Because the problem is if we create a circular firing squad, you're going to end up with the Republicans in charge. And it's that's even worse. Bill in Detroit, you wanted to correct something that we said about the Freemasons.
Yes, sir. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
Actually, the rule about being a Catholic and a Mason was actually from the Catholic side, mm-hmm. from the Catholic Church, and that rule was relaxed about 40, 50 years ago.
Oh, okay. So Catholics can now be Freemasons.
Oh, yeah. Have been for years. Several of my best friends in my lodge are.
Oh, very interesting. Okay, Bill, thanks a lot for the heads up. I appreciate that. Linda in Santa Monica, California. Hey, Linda.
Hi, Tom. Good meeting you last Friday over at the screening at the 11th hour. That was a phenomenal trip seeing that film.
Yeah, it was.
Really
it's
appreciate
a great movie.
That. And also I wanted to say that one of our well-known and famous activists, Teddy Wittegrad, who lives here in L.A., passed on yesterday.
Hmm.
So I wanted to just announce that, she was... a phenomenal person here locally, and I believe she was from the East Coast.
Okay, Linda, thank you very much. I'm sorry to hear about your loss and your community's loss. James in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, James.
Hi, I wanted to disagree with you on the banking.
Sure, back to our first hour.
I have been in the banking business for years, and I listen to your show every day, and I agree with 99% of what you say, and I've met you in person at one of your book signings, so I'm a real fan of yours.
Thank you.
But I am been in the promotion business with a very large bank. One, I don't want to mention on the air, but
sure.
But everybody wouldn't hear of it. And my job is to do some kind of a sponsorship of a fair or state fair, or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah.
And we
collect, PR for the bank, basically.
For the bank, right? Yeah. And we collect, we get people to sign up for credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who, in my 30 years of doing this, the people who actually read the contract is maybe 100 people in 30 years.
Right.
And
very rarely.
Have no idea that they're signing or the fortitude to understand a contractual agreement.
Don't you think? I mean, we passed during the Clinton administration, there was legislation passed that required that laws that were passed be in plain English, that there be some component of them that was in sufficiently plain English, and that documents from the federal government that go to people. I guess it wasn't laws. It was if the government is sending you documentation on something, it has to be in relatively plain English. Shouldn't there be some sort of a regulation that says when the bank gives you a contract, whether it's a mortgage or whether it's a credit card contract, that there is at least a paragraph, a header paragraph, sort of a headnote summary that's in plain English that summarizes what that thing says?
Well, there is, and on the contract it says, you are agreeing with this term, but I'm saying the person who's signing it doesn't understand
are not reading
it. Doing that.
Yeah, well, that's my point, is I would like to see more people actually understand what it is that they're signing. But, you know, James, your point is well made, and like the other caller, I have a certain ambivalence about this, but, you know, nonetheless. Yaron Brook tomorrow is going to be debating pharmaceutical price controls. That should be interesting. Rowan Scarborough is here about sabotage, America's enemies within the CIA. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress, and the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.